This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 10th of August 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're asking, how do you fall asleep? Our relationship with sleep is a funny one. It's something we need, sometimes it's something we fight, but often it's something that we are obsessed with. I couldn't sleep last night is a popular office catchphrase, but is that because we're all competing to be the most hard done by, or are we just all really terrible at switching off? Today we'll explore what makes us fall asleep, from bedtime stories at the Ace Hotel to a retreat for insomniacs in rural England. And we'll discuss how sleep affects creativity, or maybe being in possession of a creative mind affects your sleep. Dr. Ishad Ibrahim from the London Sleep Centre has the answers.
Creative people tend not to want to follow routines that are laid down for them. So they might want to change their sleep-wake patterns to better garner their creative talents.
That's all to come on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. So first up, we'll investigate the slightly more medical side of things with a sleep doctor. Not just any old one, though. Dr. Ishad Ibrahim is the founding white coat behind the London Sleep Centre. With a background in psychiatry, I wonder if we'll learn that sleep really is all in the mind. It doesn't feel that way when you wake up at 3 a.m. for a wee and end up having to try and name all the capitals of the world in alphabetical order in order to get back to dreamland, but I began by asking Dr. Ibrahim about the link between sleep and creativity.
We don't know about it because there hasn't been any substantial or substantive research on sleep and creativity. But what we do know is a lot of artists and a lot of my patients who are in the creative industry tend to have sleep issues. And they might not be sleep disorders or dysfunctions, but they are sleep issues. They might not feel comfortable working on a 9-to-5 routine. Creative people tend not to want to follow routines that are laid down for them. So they might want to change their sleep-wake patterns to better garner their creative talents.
Yeah, this is the thing, isn't it? And I wonder, it's interesting that you say that because it is a bit of a stereotype, the kind of person that wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning or has to stay up all night in their studio painting or recording an album or whatever it might be. But it is almost measurable. There is a correlation between, if not creativity and a lack of sleep or sleeping at different times of day, but the fact that the mind works in different ways when the night falls.
The mind works in and the brain works in a different way when night falls. But I think when it comes to creative people, there's a thing called inspiration. And are you inspired? And at what time are you inspired? And are you inspired for a period of time? So that's 36 to 72 hours without any sleep at all. And in that time, you know, you could paint half the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Yeah. Or is it about the timing of the day when you feel inspired? So if the inspiration rush continues, then you'll be completely sleep deprived, almost in a manic state. And we know a lot of people, you know, a significant proportion of very highly successful creative people have or would be considered to have a bipolar manic type of disorder because they're up for ages and they're hyperactive and they have very speedy thoughts and are able to create. But then if you take someone else who feels that they're only creative at night, that person might actually have a delayed sleep phase disorder.
Do people tend to come to you, say a creative person, an artist perhaps comes to you and is willing to take on board the fact that they have their best sort of creative time from 2 a.m. until 5 a.m. or something, and they want you to help them the rest of the time? Or do they want you to stop that and feel that they can be creative during office hours, if you know what I mean?
I think when they come and see me, they come and see me once they start developing symptoms.
Yeah.
So up to that point where they don't have symptoms, that suits them. The human brain and the human body is very flexible in terms of what it can and can't do. You know, these strict sleep regimes that some people advocate, they are there for people who've got sleep symptoms and sleep disorders. We're in the clinical spectrum. But a lot of us can function by having late nights and quite happily function the next day and not really have any. But when someone who's creative and who's been used to having a reversed sleep-wake cycle and being working at night and functioning that way and being successful that way, then starts developing symptoms, it's at that point that they knock on my door and say, right, now you know, I'm feeling tired in the day. I'm not able to get as much sleep as I used to, despite having been up the whole night. And it's at that point that we need to intervene with changing their habits, perhaps giving them some medication, helping them restructure their sleep-wake routine.
We're always told that this is becoming ever closer, this kind of the lack of sleep epidemic. Do you see it that way, or do you just you see each individual patient and each individual sort of symptom as it comes?
I think we have to take a view at various levels. So at the huge population level, yes, our sleep is being disrupted. We've become so over-industrialized, over-computerized, over-gadgetized. You know, you don't need an expert to tell you that. Get rid of the devices. So we've got to take that into account at the population level. And, you know, if Apple keeps on selling and Samsung keeps on selling devices and marketing them and doing all of that, people keep using them compulsively like they do, then yes, it's going to affect you because it's keeping you more alert when you shouldn't be alert. It's giving you light, the type of light, bright light to your eyes that you shouldn't be getting. And all of these will impact. So yes, is there a strain on our natural sleep rhythm? The answer is yes. Is that resulting in more sleep symptoms? Inevitably, yes, it would. And would that result in more sleep disorders? Yes, it does.
When you see patients for their sleep, are you delving into your knowledge of psychiatry very obviously? Can they see you joining the dots between something that is about the physical training of the brain to shut it off and to wake it up at certain times to train that muscle, as we were talking about before? Or are you tempted to see, do you try not to see perhaps the more deep-seated reasons?
Well, they're all interlinked because they've all got to do with the brain. And that part of the brain that's involved in sleep is also where the majority of the psychiatric issues arise out.
Yeah.
And in fact, if we go back in history, the founders of sleep medicine were psychiatrists. Mm. It was, you know, until the development of sleep apnea, sleep medicine, as we call it today, was dominated by psychiatry. The same chemistry is involved in sleep as it is in psychiatry, and most psychiatric illnesses start off with the sleep complaint.
Yeah.
So if you can treat the sleep problem, and this is where I...
You sort of nip the rest of it in the bud.
Yeah, perhaps. It's a preventative medicine approach. If you develop the sleep problem, you develop insomnia, you have chronic insomnia, you're going to become depressed or anxious or both. Now, if you nip that in the bud, the healthcare utilization of that patient is reduced manyfold. So you've prevented someone developing a chronic mental illness.
It's fascinating stuff, isn't it? Because once you ask one question, and suddenly we've opened this whole sort of Pandora's box.
It is. And when you look at physical health, you know, people with physical illness like cardiac illnesses or cancer, or once you optimize sleep, you improve their outcomes. So, you know, there is this fascination about what we still don't know, the function of sleep. We know what happens, we can measure it and all of that, and we can see what's going wrong in it. But what is the function of sleep? We know without it, you can't survive for a long time. If you don't get enough of it, you'll develop immune dysfunction, depression, even psychosis. But what is the function of sleep? And can we use sleep to heal? Even in an ill body and even in a diseased body, if we can optimize sleep, can we, for example, optimize and increase the lifespan of someone with cancer or with heart disease? These are the important things to look at from a medical perspective.
I wonder whether you sometimes, it annoys you that there is such a kind of link between the grandstanding idea of sleeplessness and creativity, the kind of almost the rock and roll idea, the kind of grand, the flamboyant artist idea of the creative expression of sort of sleeplessness. Does that aggravate you when you kind of go, do you know what, you'd probably be better getting away with a straight 8 hours of sleep and then try painting a masterpiece?
Well, you know, someone might not be able to paint a masterpiece after having 8 hours of sleep.
Okay.
What might happen is after he's sleep deprived and does a masterpiece, the sleep that he gets after sleep depriving himself will consolidate his creativity. So the next time he sleep deprives himself, he'll probably be...
He'll be bolstered by it.
Correct.
Okay.
So, you know, I am not a concrete thinker by any means, and you cannot be, because, you know, the humanity has got such a wide range of creative talent. And if someone is creative at 3 o'clock in the morning, then by all means, go and be creative at 3 o'clock in the morning. But ensure, once you've been creative, have your 7 to 8 hours sleep, so that the next 24 hours, you can be creative again.
That was Dr. Ishad Ibrahim from the London Sleep Centre. You can find out more information at londonsleepcentre.com. Well, we've investigated the creative mind, but how do you quiet it down to get some rest? How about a bedtime story? A new installation at the Ace Hotel wants to bring back the sleepy time ritual of being read to. The hotel rooms in Los Angeles and London now offer a channel on their in-house radio station that promises to lull you to sleep with new bedtime stories just for adults. They've partnered up with Visual Editions, a literary publisher known for its creative approach to commission bedtime stories from local authors in those two cities. The in-room installation has the stories set to sleepy sounds and offers an audio experience sure to bring you to the astral plane. Lily Ames went to the Ace Hotel to hear more.
When most people walk into a hotel room, they flop down on the bed, checking its buoyancy like a ritual. I look for the radio. What I will be listening to is as important as what I will be sleeping on. For me, there's comfort in hearing people's voices. And there's nothing more comforting than that bedtime story. But who will read to you when you're a grown-up? Books on tape don't really feel the same, do they? That's why the Ace Hotel says their stories are specially written and recorded for the adult, sleepily inclined. I walk into the hotel room, turn on the audio, and flop down on the bed to find out for myself.
Instructions for Improvement by Brian DeLue. Please, lie down. Make yourself as comfortable as possible. We've designed this space to resemble your own bedroom, but we know there are unavoidable differences. The IV drip. The day and night simulation lamps. Still, we hope you can feel some affinity for this place. It's important that your dreaming mind be at ease.
Now that certainly isn't your typical book on tape. It's dreamy. Anna Gerber is with Visual Editions, the publishing house behind this installation.
Typically, when people think of bedtime stories, they think of bedtime stories for children. And these are definitely bedtime stories for adults because they cover adult-ish material, a sexy and dark and sinister kind of mysterious kind of way. So we were interested in how to make bedtime stories for adults and what that would feel like, but then also maybe to tap into some of the nostalgia of what it does feel like to be read to, and that that's actually a deeply comforting, warming, intimate experience.
Impure Thoughts by Will Self. It was in San Francisco at the tail end of 1989. I'd gone to California to do a magazine story on the cryonicists. You know, those weirdos who believe that if their bodies can be frozen to near absolute zero immediately after death, it'll be possible to thaw them out in the future, by which time medical science will have advanced enough to put right whatever it...
When we were commissioning the writers both here and in LA, we really wanted a mix. We wanted to stretch the possibilities of what a bedtime story can be. It could be a fairy tale. It could be something dark and mysterious. It could be something funny. And we just really put out as many possibilities as possible to see what came back. We were really excited to, or really curious to see what LA writers would come back with compared to London writers. So the locality is really important, and that's an important detail with Ace as well, to kind of tap into those local creative communities. So for the London stories, Will Self wrote a raunchy escapade. Zoe Pilger wrote quite a dark, mysterious story. Joanna Walsh wrote a very funny, whimsical story about a dog in a hotel room. With the LA stories, there's Jessica Garrison, who writes about a drunk guy on a porch. There's Brian DeLue, who writes a kind of sci-fi tale about a doctor. And there's Amy Bender, who writes about an insomniac.
The Suitcase Dog by Joanna Walsh. Pets up to 25 pounds are allowed to check into your room with you and stay by your side. I am the Suitcase Dog. My head fits through a hole. I am portable. My jaws snap shut on hinges. In the hotel, there is no postman. In the hotel, there is no letterbox. My jaws snap shut on nothing.
My name is Joanna Walsh. I'm a writer, and I wrote a story for the Ace Hotel called The Suitcase Dog. It's probably not as soothing as a bedtime story might ideally be, but I guess it has some kind of event that takes place, and then at the end, things are resolved. Whatever you think of that resolution. So there's a sense of ending, a sense of closure, which might be appropriate to the end of the day. I think people do want to be taken on a journey. They do want to let their mind go in new directions. Their minds are relaxed, and they do want to be soothed.
A lot of the stories has something to do with sleep in it, but I guess sleep can be something quite sinister. It's not always necessarily a poetic thing, and I think that was quite interesting for us to see, and that's why when we briefed the writers and also selected the writers, we were really keen for that to come through. Not necessarily the sinister element, but just to see what would come back. So I guess my answer to what a bedtime story would be is it's completely open to interpretation and exploration and to read something unexpected.
But sinister, unexpected, and lovely are all qualities of some classic children's bedtime stories, too. So perhaps adult bedtime stories are not so far away from their junior counterparts.
You know, a lot of them are quite alarming. I can remember being told Beatrix Potter, who's quite an alarming writer, The Tale of Samuel Whiskers, which was considered, you know, perfectly good material for a bedtime story, but it's about a kitten who is nearly eaten by a pair of rats who kidnap him, tie him up, and try to bake him into a pudding. So that's, you know, pretty alarming too. I'm not sure that bedtime stories really are that soothing.
Soothing or not, the bedtime stories installation at the Ace is sure to take you on a journey before you drift off. And if you're not staying at the Ace, it's available online for you to listen to at home. For Monocle in London, I'm Lily Ames.
Thanks, Lily. If you're still awake after the soothing sounds of those readers, then stick around for the second half of the show when we'll find out what happens at a sleep retreat.
The perfect way to start the day in Europe is with Monocle's morning news programme, The Globalist. Join Monocle 24's editors, presenters and guests as they set the agenda in international news and business. The show's weekly series unpacks an idea over the course of a week, hearing from the creative thinkers and dynamic characters shaping the sector. The Globalist delves deeper to bring you the full story. Every day, the show's guest newspaper reviewer trains a critical eye and plenty of expertise and wit on the best periodicals from Australia to Japan and India to Turkey. You'll also get the big stories in the business world from a key market every day. We have regular contributors across Europe and the Middle East. The Globalist premieres every weekday at the new time of 1500 hours in Tokyo, 9 a.m. in Istanbul and 7 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Notwithstanding the brilliant creative work that insomnia may fuel, for the vast majority of those afflicted with sleep deprivation, its adverse effects, psychological and physical, far outweigh the advantages of a few more waking hours. For a quarter of a decade, Jonathan Grant lived with insomnia while running a successful business and raising a family. Fed up with the prescriptions for antidepressants he was getting from his doctor, he found a new approach to dealing with his condition based on cognitive behavioural therapy, or CBT. This method now forms the backbone of the holistic sleep treatment on offer at the Sleep Retreat, a centre founded by Jonathan in the 14th century Riversdown estate in Hampshire, England. Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan met up with him to find out more.
Sleep problems really divide themselves into two broad problems. One is physiological, i.e. there's actually something wrong with the body, and that's largely in the area of sleep apnea. So your windpipe can become blocked and therefore you don't sleep. You keep waking up because, in fact, you're suffocating. Snoring is a mild form of sleep apnea. And then there's a psychological side of it. And I think the truth is that the psychological side, the lives we all lead, these busy lives now with our machines and our devices and our email We are all 24-hour operations these days. And if you don't relax, if you don't give yourself some time, then you don't give yourself a chance to sleep. And it's the most natural bodily function that we have is sleep. So I realised that this was available, but the sleep industry is itself, even within the NHS, is absolutely tiny. And yet the problem is so massive. It's all pervasive. 37% of people suffer from insomnia at some point in their lives. It's massive. And I realised that if I could try and persuade a few of these sleep experts to work with me, then we'd have a chance at the sleep retreat for people to come, to unwind, to relax, to learn about sleep, and to get their life straight. And the results have been absolutely stunning.
So what can people expect when they come to your sleep retreat?
Well, the retreat itself is a 70-acre estate just outside Winchester in Hampshire. It is absolutely quiet. There's no ambient light from any of the cities. It's a 14th-century hunting lodge with three other buildings, one of which we've converted specifically into an environment where they come and sleep. And they enjoy a program. It's the best and most effective program is our 5-day, 4-night program. We look at the world of sleep, the science of sleep, and the basic principles they need to understand. There's some pretty fundamental mathematics behind getting to sleep, actually. When is your sleep window? When you as a human being, should you be at sleep? Someone like myself is generally 11 till 7. Other people, 10 till 5. Some people, 1 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock in the morning. There's no right or wrong, per se. But what is important is that people do get sleep. So we look very closely at that. We then have a wellness program. So we have a gym, we have massage, we have sauna, we have a swimming pool, we have golf course, we have cycling, all those sorts of things. We have a social program, which can include things like music, poetry. We have guided walks locally and do things that perhaps an art as well, actually, is a great way of using the mind in a way that maybe most people don't on a weekly basis. But we also focus on nutrition, so in getting the body and mind in line. And what we're trying to do is not make it such an unreal world that people, when they get back to their own environment, can't survive and it's all just... It's always like, oh, that was a dream and now I'm back in reality and I'm going to get back to my old habits. We're trying to do it in a way that actually they leave armed with the tools by which they can continue to keep the disciplines in place.
Do you find that there are particular types of people, perhaps people from particular occupational backgrounds, who are more likely to have sleep problems and to come to you than others?
I thought there would be a pattern, but there really isn't. It's across every facet of society, to be honest. We've had, through the program, we've had a 22-year-old student. We've had a number of students through the program, actually. Successful business people. We've had people who've retired, people who've never worked in their lives, to be honest. It's been an extraordinary mix of people. Maybe the academics can give you something more certain than that, but certainly in what we've seen, the applications that we get, the people we see coming through the retreat, is a very broad spectrum.
And do you think that there are aspects to our culture, perhaps our culture in, you know, developed West industrialized nations, which are actively harmful to getting good sleep?
My background is business, I suppose, so I'm fascinated by that. If you looked at the Sunday Times article yesterday, it said that people in Tokyo sleep 6 hours and people in London sleep 7. And I don't know exactly why that is, but I suspect that there's a commercial imperative behind this. In France, they've tried to bring in laws where you're not allowed to answer your email or send emails outside working hours. And it sounds faintly absurd, but actually, I think it's actually quite a good idea. And I try and limit myself in that way as well, but inevitably you have a glance because you think there might be something important there. I think the technology itself has invaded our lives to the point where, whether it's business or pleasure or even looking at your Facebook page in the evening, it's actually not particularly healthy. If you can do something simple like cook and read and maybe watch a little bit of television, but not too much, and don't take the laptop to bed, I don't think it's healthy. It's proven not to be particularly healthy. It's certainly not good for your sleep if your mind is worrying. And a lot of the people we come across, they're tired, they're sleepy tired in the world of sleep is a phrase we use. They're sleepy tired. But as soon as they get anywhere near their bedroom, they start becoming anxious. And it's a question of how you treat that, how you deal with that. And there are all sorts of techniques that have been developed by some very eminent professors and academics and now being put into practice. And my frustration is that it's such a small world for such a massive problem. And there's some great people in the world of sleep and there just simply aren't enough of them.
That was Jonathan Grant, founder of The Sleep Retreat, speaking to Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan. To finish the show, we're going to hear from Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker. He muses on his own relationship with sleep from childhood to adulthood and on either side of the Atlantic. sleep, you beautiful escape, you fluffy slumber, you. Some of my best rests are the unexpected ones, the sitting on a train moment when my head lolls back, my mouth opens and dribble starts to escape. Then to cap it all, I wake myself up with a lone but loud snort. Probably no bad thing given the spectacle I must be providing for my fellow passengers. Those siestas. 4 years of living in Argentina as a freelance journalist and the freedom to have a little downtime in the early evening. Half an hour of lying on a bed, no need to even necessarily drop off completely, and a welcome energy boost for the rest of the evening. Something that I would need if I was going to keep up with the tradition of eating post 2200 and then go out for drinks until the wee hours. Now in New York, I rarely get those power nap chances anymore. Much as I enjoy sleep, it sometimes escapes me. I remember when I was 18 being able to sleep for 12 hours, and when I say sleep, it sometimes felt like I'd been cracked over the skull with a blunt instrument. My head would hit the pillow and I'd be out for the count until 10 or 11 the next morning. It was deep, undisturbed dreamtime. Skip forward to present day and things aren't quite the same. I get to sleep fine, but I often wake up in the middle of the night. I don't feel anxious, but I sometimes struggle to turn the chatter off in my brain. I went to the doctor recently about an unrelated matter and decided to bring up my sleep pattern. A doctor in the UK would immediately ask background questions. Was I anxious about something or feeling stressed? How was my diet? Was I getting enough exercise? In America, it seems, the answer comes in the form of a little white tablet. Drugs. And it's a major cultural difference. Instead of looking concerned, my doctor broke into a wide grin, and I'm pretty sure he gave me a wink. "What do you want?" he asked me toothily. I suddenly felt like I was speaking to a street pusher, not a man of medicine. I turned down his generous offer. I'll keep it old school for now, I think, and stick to counting sheep. For Monocle in New York, I'm Ed Stocker.
Thanks, Ed. So how do you fall asleep? On your left, on your back, only with the help of a little company, or a lot? Do you have to switch off slowly like an old TV set, or are you out like a light? It seems that maybe we've muddied the waters as much as gloried in their crystal clarity, but learned a little as we've done so. Sleep is a blessing and a curse to the creative mind, and much has been made of it between the covers of books, the words of songs, and on the canvases of artists. But you know, it's a question of each to their own. If you could harness the power of sleep like a comic book baddie, well, you could rule the world. You can have too much of it, but we can't get enough of it. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was the never soporific, always terrific Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. Thank you very much for tuning in.